Welcome to Love's Tender Flame, Stories of Romance. I'm Mardell, reading The Auction Block by Rex Beach. Chapter 9. Lorelei was not a little mystified by Merkel's cryptic message, for she could imagine no possible way in which she or the writer himself could be connected discreditably with Jarvis Hammond's affair. She gained some light, however, when that evening she read the note to Lilas.
"Why, they're going to blackmail Merkel, too!" Lilas exclaimed. "Well, they'd be foolish to let him off, wouldn't they? Two millionaires out with two showgirls. Hilarious foursome at the chateau. Automobile wreck. Foxy Pinkertons and flashlight photographs. Nice story."
"So they think he'll pay to keep his name out of the papers?"
"Exactly. And he will, for your sake."
"I won't let him."
Lilas was surprised.
"Why, he's rich. They wouldn't miss a few thousand."
"You wouldn't allow Mr. Hammond to be robbed, would you?"
"Oh, wouldn't I? If he didn't care enough for me to protect me from scandal, I'd want to know it."
"Lilas, you puzzle me," confessed Lorelei doubtfully. "You say things that make me think you don't care for him at all. And then again, you seem to be crazy about him. How do you feel? How far would you go with him?"
Lilas laughed airily. "Perhaps I'd go farther with him than for him. He asked me to marry him if his wife gets a divorce, and I agreed. Does that answer your question?"
"I suppose it does."
"Now that he's come to the point, I'm not sorry things happened just as they did. A woman must look out for herself. No man will ever help her. It's worth some notoriety to become Mrs. Jarvis Hammond."
Something in the speaker's words rang false. But just what that something was, Lorelei could not decide.
"Then you'd like to see the story made public?" she queried.
"Naturally."
"I dare say if I loved a man, I'd want him at any price, but I hope I'm not going to be dragged into this matter."
"My dear, New York has blackmailing newspapers just as it has blackmailing men. They live off people like Merkel. You'd be foolish to let him escape from this just to save a few dollars, for the notoriety will injure you, where it benefits me. It's not often that girls in our business know men like those two. You have a family. They can make Merkel do the right thing by you."
"I don't want him to do anything," protested Lorelei. "There's nothing to do."
"You could make him marry you."
Lorelei winced.
"Nonsense. I don't care for him. He's an old man. There's no reason why he should."
"He could be made to pay, at least. And you'll be sorry if you don't get something out of him. Just wait and see what a difference the story makes with your other men friends."
During the ensuing performance, Lorelei pondered her friend's disquieting prophecy. Yet she could see no reason for grave apprehension. Publicity of the kind threatened would, of course, be disagreeable, but how it could seriously affect her was not apparent. Later in the evening, Robert Wharton appeared as usual, and so resentful was he at the deceptions previously practiced upon him that Lorelei with difficulty escaped a scene. He declared positively that he was not to be discouraged, that he proposed to have his attentions accepted at any cost, even if it became necessary to use force. He seemed sufficiently drunk to execute his threat, and his invitation to supper was couched this time more in the terms of a command. At last he borrowed a stool from the judge, who by now was his willing vassal, and planted himself in the hallway, where he remained throughout the performance, a gloomy, watchful figure. Lorelei came down boldly, dressed for the street, and since she could not pass the besieger, excused herself briefly. Descending the basement stairs, she crossed under the stage, made her way into the orchestra pit, and managed to leave the theater by the front door. She was waiting when Jim came home and followed him into his room, where they could talk without disturbing their father. Lorelei made her accusation boldly, prepared for the usual burst of anger, but Jim listened patiently until she paused.
"I knew you had to spill this, so I let you rave," said he. "But it's too late. Somebody's been after Hammond for a long time, and he's been got, yes, and got good. Take a flash at the chorus girl's Bible." He tossed his sister a copy of a prominent theatrical paper. "I waited until it came out," Lorelei gasped, for on the front page glared black-typed headlines of the Hammond scandal. John Merkel's name was there, too, and linked with it her own.
"Jim," she cried aghast, "they promised to kill the story."
"Charlie Murphy himself couldn't kill that."
"Oh, what is this?"
She ran her eye swiftly down the column.
"Sure, Melcher commenced suit against Hammond this afternoon. $50,000 for alienation of Lila's affections. Joke, eh? He claims it was a common law marriage and he'll get the coin."
"But Mrs. Hammond?"
"The evidence is in her hands already. Dates, places, photographs, everything. She'll win her suit, too."
"Why, it sounds like a deliberate plot. But I don't understand who's behind it. What part did you have in it, Jim? Were you helping Mr. Melcher in his blackmail scheme, or..."
Another possibility came to her.
"Were you, by any chance, working for Mrs. Hammond?"
Divining his sister's prejudice, Jim lied, promptly and convincingly.
"Why, Mrs. Hammond, of course, I had a chance to turn a few dollars, and I took it."
"But why did they drag me in? Couldn't you keep me out of it? Oh, this is dreadful."
As she ran her eye over the article, she saw that it was quite in harmony with the general tone and policy of the paper, which catered to the jaded throngs of the Tenderloin. Truth had been cunningly distorted. Flippancy, sensationalism, and a salacious double meaning ran through it all.
"What's dreadful about it?" inquired her brother. "That sort of advertising does a showgirl good. You've got to make people talk about you, sis, and this'll bring a gang of high rollers your way. You've been so blame proper, nobody's interested in you anymore."
For a moment, Lorelei scrutinized her brother in silence, taken aback at his outrageous philosophy. Jim had changed greatly, she mused. Not until very lately had she observed the full measure of the change in him. He was no longer the country boy, the playmate and confidant of her youth, but a man, sophisticated, hard, secretive. He had been thoroughly Manhattanized, she perceived, and he was as foreign to her as a stranger. She shook her head hopelessly.
"You're a strange brother," she said. "I hardly know what to make of you. Has the city killed every decent instinct in you, Jim?"
"Now don't begin on the old home stuff," he replied testily. "I haven't changed any more than you have. Why, Ma used to think you'd play dead or jump through whenever she snapped her finger, but you're getting tough-bitted. You're getting sanctimonious in your old age. Where you got it from, I don't know. Not from Ma, surely, nor from Dad. He's a cheater and always has been.
Jim!
Aye, you know it. I'm wondering how long you'll stand pat.
What do you mean?
Do you really intend to marry a bunch of coin?
That's the program, isn't it? I've been raised for that and nothing else.
Well, Ma can't put it over, so I guess it's up to me. Just leave things to Brother Jim. Don't worry over what happens. Nobody along Broadway pays any attention to this rot.
He indicated the newspaper with a wave of his cigar. After a moment, he added,
Would you accept Merkel?
Lorelei shivered.
Oh, no, not Mr. Merkel.
Why not? He's all right and he won't last long.
Oh, the ideas. Ugh. He wouldn't ask me, and I shan't allow you to use this scandal to urge him. The proposition sounds all right in the abstract. Marry, money, comfort, everything I want, but when it comes right down to the point, I always balk.
Well, you ought to consider the rest of us a little bit. Pa could be cured, Ma'd be happy, and I could get on my feet. How about Bob Wharton?
He's a drunkard.
Good Lord, you don't expect to grab a divinity student, do you? That kind never has anything.
Let's not talk about it, please. Mr. Wharton is getting nasty, and I'm beginning to be afraid of him.
Oh, I'll bet you can land him.
Please, I don't want to think about it. I dare say I'll bring myself to marry some rich men some day, but Merkel,
Wharton, she shuddered for a second time.
If Mr. Wharton is serious, well, this scandal will scare him off, or else he'll become just like the others. I could cry. He threatened me tonight. I don't know how I'll manage to avoid him tomorrow night.
He's coming on that strong, eh?
Was Jim's interested query, but on hearing his sister's account of the young millionaire's determined pursuit, he volunteered in his offhand way to his sister.
I'll come for you myself. We'll whip over to a cafe for supper.
You'll save me from him, said Lorelei with a wan smile, and I'll know that you are in good company for one evening at least.
Don't lose any sleep over my habits, he told her lightly. And don't worry yourself about this newspaper story either. Melcher's in the right for Hammond. Cut him out with Lilas.
He's after Merkel, too, so you'll have to stand the gaff this time.
I'll look up this chap Wharton tomorrow and find out what sort of a farmer's son he really is.
As Jim and his mother breakfasted together on the following morning, he broached the subject of his recent conversation with Lorelei.
"Is she sore about the story?" he said. "We had a long talk last night."
"I knew she would be, and I'm not sure it was a good thing."
"I will drag something out of it if you do your part. Merkel will pay. I don't mention money. Nothing but marriage, understand? Outraged motherhood, ruined daughter, blasted career. Now that's yours. I'll be the brother who's in position of a father to her. I can threaten, but you mustn't. And Goldberg will close for us."
"I don't see why we have to divide with a lawyer. When it's our affair, we can handle it ourselves," his mother complained.
"I tell you, it's got to go through the regular channels. This was Melcher's idea, and since I'm in on the Hammond money, Max is entitled to his bit of this. Gee, if she'd only told us she was going out with Merkel, we might have framed something worthwhile. I don't mind telling you, this is a pretty weak case."
"He won't stand publicity. They never do," avowed Mrs. Knight.
"And he's not like Hammond. He hasn't got a family, and Lorelei won't back us up either. We've got to bluff it through."
"Wouldn't he marry her?"
Not a chance. In the first place, she wouldn't have him. Bob Wharton is the white hope. She hates him, too. Goodness knows what we're going to do with her. I think she'll stand for Wharton if we work her right. It's him or nobody. She's getting harder to handle every day, though, and one of these times she'll fall for some rummy. If she ever does lose her head, she'll skid for the ditch. We can kiss ourselves goodbye. She'll be as easy to steer as a wild boar by the tail. I guess you're sorry now you didn't listen to me and let Max handle her before she got wise. I wouldn't feel safe with any of that crowd. I'd be terribly afraid.
Mrs. Knight shook her head dubiously.
Say, she's got you doing it, too. They don't take a chance. Goldberg handles the legal end. And his brother is in the legislature. But that's not all. Melcher's partner in his gambling house is Inspector Snell. And you can't beat that. I could have Merkel killed for $500 and never stand a pinch. I'd merely tip one of Maxie's gunmen. Some night, old Dyspepsia Dick would wake up with a harp in his hand. Then I'd get him coming out of his bank or going to his club or leaving the theater. Nobody would dream who did it, for there wouldn't be a motive. It's done every day, Ma. Even if they grabbed one of the boys, Melcher would spring him from the tombs. Alibi is Maxie's middle name, and he makes bondsmen. How do you suppose politics are run in this town, anyhow?
That isn't politics. That's murder.
Mrs. Knight was deeply shocked.
This is a terrible city, Jim.
Sure, but Max is in politics for the protection it gives him in his other lines of business. His gambling house is safe as a church. There's big money in this banker hunting, too. Did you read about the two old guys at the King William Hotel last month? Well, Max laid 'em against two squabs, friends of Tony's. He got the girls into the hotel, paid their bills, and all of that. They've cleaned up about 20,000 so far. Of course, Lorelei won't stand for anything like that, so we've got to marry her, I suppose.
Just the same, I'm frightened, and this isn't honest. I wish she would listen to Robert Wharton.
James winked meaningly.
Yeah, leave that to me. She's going to Proctor's with me tonight. Maybe he'll join us. But meanwhile, we got Merkel for some quick money if we work him right. I'm off for Goldie's office now. I'll meet you at 3.
When Jim reappeared, dressed for the street, he gave a bit of parting advice.
Better lay on the hysterics when she wakes up. It'll make it easier for me tonight.
Lorelei found her mother visibly upset by the story in the morning's newspaper.
You told me you only went to supper with that man,
Mrs. Knight cried tragically.
Instead of that, you two were off in the country together all night. Here's the whole thing.
She brandished the paper dramatically.
Well, I told you a fib, but there's no harm done.
Harm? Indeed, you're ruined. I never read anything more disgraceful. I daren't show it to Peter. It would kill him. Whatever possessed you after the way we've watched over you, after the care we've taken of you? Oh, it's terrible.
Please don't carry on so. It was too bad, of course, but I'll live through it.
The shock of this callous assertion seemed to rob Mrs. Knight of speech. She stared at her daughter in grief and amazement.
Mr. Merkel is a gentleman, Lorelei defended. He'll regret this publicity as much as I.
The wretch! I'll teach him to spoil an innocent girl's career and drag her name in the mud.
Mrs. Knight glared balefully.
You'll do nothing of the sort, said her daughter sharply.
He ought to marry you.
Why, mother, you're more insulting than that newspaper.
The career of a showgirl is something of a joke. Lorelei undertook to laugh. But the attempt failed rather dismally.
Indeed, what will other men say? You had a character. Nobody could say a word against you until now. Do you think any decent man would marry a girl who did a thing like this? Of course, I know you're a good girl, but they don't. They'll believe absolutely the worst. You've spoiled everything, my dear. I'm completely discouraged.
Mrs. Knight began to weep in a weak, heartbroken manner, expecting Lorelei to melt as usual. But seeing something in her daughter's expression that warned her not to carry her reproaches too far, she broke out.
It was so hard, so unreasonable. Don't you see I'm frantic with worry? You're all we have, and the thought of an injury to your prospects nearly kills me. You misunderstand everything I say. I wish you were safely married and out of danger. I think I could die happy then. It means so much to all of us to have you settled right away. Peter is failing every day. Jim is going to the dogs, and I'm sick over it all. I wish I were married and out of the way. You would all be fixed at least. I don't much care about myself.
Lorelei sighed in hopeless weariness of spirit, for variations of this scene had been common of late, and they always filled her with the blackest pessimism.
Maybe Mr. Merkle. We'll leave him out of this, declared Lorelei. He is too decent to have a person like me foisted upon him, and there is no reason whatever why he should be held responsible for my notoriety.
She turned away from the dining room with a shudder of distaste.
I don't want any breakfast. I think I'll get some air.
As soon as she was out in the street, she turned southward involuntarily and set off toward the establishment of Adderay Demarest. Mrs. Knight dried her eyes and began to dress herself carefully, preparatory to a journey into the Wall Street section of the city, for the hour was drawing on toward 3 o'clock. Meanwhile, Jim, having transacted his business at Goldberg's office, sought a more familiar haunt on one of the side streets among the 40s. Here, just off Broadway, was a famous barber shop, a spotless place with white interior and tiled walls. 6 Italians, in stiff duck coats, practiced their arts at a row of well-equipped chairs. A wasp-waisted girl sat at the manicure table next to the front windows. As Jim entered, she was holding the hand of a jaded person in a light gray suit and murmuring over it, with an occasional upward glance from a pair of bold dark eyes. Tony the barber's place was thoroughly antiseptic. Dirt was a stranger there. Germs found life within its portals a hazardous business. What with the vitrified walls, the glass shelves, and enameled plumbing, even the towels were handled with tongs. The nickel-plated steamer in which they were heated to an unbearable temperature seemed to puff its cheeks with a consciousness of painful and almost offensive cleanliness. The men who worked there had hard black eyes, but their hands were soft and white. The rows of mugs that stood inside the glass cupboards were inscribed with the names of prominent actors, managers, and booking agents of the Rialto, for this was a famous place in its way. Tony, engaged in administering a shampoo, nodded at Jim and from force of habit murmured politely, "Next." Then, with a meaning glance, he indicated a door at the rear of the shop. In the third chair, Jim recognized Max Melcher, although the face of the sporting man was swathed in steaming cloths. Jim passed on and into a rear room, where he found 3 men seated at a felt-covered card table. They were well-dressed, quiet persons. One a bookmaker whom the racing laws had reduced from affluence to comparative penury. Another a tall, pallid youth with bulging eyes. The third occupant of the room was an ex-lightweight champion of the ring,
Young Sullivan by name, his trim waist and powerful shoulders betokened his trade. His jaw was firm, and a cauliflower ear overhung his collar like a fungus. Jim drew up a chair and chatted idly until the bookmaker yawned, rose, and went out. Then Jim and the others relaxed.
"Gee, he's a sticker," exclaimed the pugilist. "I thought he'd broke his back."
"Max is getting his map greased," the pop-eyed youth explained, taking a pasteboard box from his pocket. He removed a heroin tablet therefrom and crushed it, the powder he held in the indentation between the base of his closed thumb and first finger, known as the thimble. Then with a quick inhalation, he drew the drug up his nostrils. "Have an angel?" he inquired, offering the box. Jim accepted, but young Sullivan declined. "What's the news?" the latter inquired. "I've seen Goldie," replied Jim. "Mother and I will call in Merkel at 3. I finally got her to consent." Sullivan shook his head.
"He might fall, but I doubt it. How does your sister feel?"
"Ah, that's the trouble. She's square. We can't use her," Jim explained. "Some doll," admiringly commented Armistead, the third member of the group. Armistead had once been famed in vaudeville for dancing, but the drug habit had destroyed his endurance, and with it his career. "She's a perfect 36, all right. She could rip a lot of coin loose if she tried." At this moment, Mr. Melcher, freshly perfumed and talcumed, entered the room. His white hair was arranged with scrupulous nicety. His pink face, as unwrinkled as his immaculate attire, was beaming with good humor.
"Well, boys, I'm the pay car," he smiled.
"Hammond came through, eh?"
Sullivan inquired eagerly.
"Not exactly. We compromise quick sales and small profits. That's business."
"How strong did he go?" queried Armistead.
"Now, what's the difference so long as you get yours? Photography is a paying business."
Melcher laughed agreeably.
"Sure. I'll bet Serenity's rich."
Young Sullivan carelessly accepted the roll of currency which Melcher tossed him, and the others did likewise.
"I suppose that's curtain for us," Jim said regretfully.
"It is. The rest is Lila's affair."
"Say, will the old man fall again?" queried Armistead.
"He's going to marry her."
The three others stared at him in amazement.
"Right," confirmed Melcher. "She's got a stranglehold on him."
"Maybe we haven't lost the last card yet," Sullivan ventured.
Jim seconded the thought.
"She's got an ace buried somewhere. There's a lot more in her head than hairpins. I wish Merkel would marry my sister."
"Not a chance," Melcher declared.
"You'll be lucky to shake him down for a few thousand. How about Wharton? Will she stand for him?"
Jim frowned, and his voice was rough as he replied,
"I'll make her stand for him if it's a Mary. He's a lush. If you got him stewed, he might go that far. It has been done, but of course it's all up to the girl. Anyhow, if he balks at the altar, we might get him for something else."
"I'm not sure I'll need any help in this." Jim looked up coldly. "If he marries her, that ends it. If we have to frame him, of course I'll split."
"How are you going to frame him with a square dame like Lorelei?" asked Armistead.
"Frame both of them," Melcher said shortly. "By the way, he's a gambler too, isn't he? Bring him in some night, Jim, and I'll turn for him myself." "Save his cuff buttons for me," laughed young Sullivan, idly riffing the cards. "Gee, money comes easy to some folks. Don't you guys never expect
to do any honest work?
Join me next time for another romantic chapter of The Auction Block by Rex Beach, here on Love's Tender Flame. Until then, love deeply and live beautifully.